Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I would say that this year the crop is probably a good 7 to 10 days ahead of average at this point in time.
Talking crop progress, Romolo Lolato, Kansas State Wheat Production Specialist.
I was even talking to some growers from South Central Kansas. They think that if the crop maintains the pace, they're going to be harvesting first week of June, which is probably a week earlier than they would usually stop and start. So right now we are about 7 to 10 days ahead of average. Whether that's going to stay like that or not is going to depend on the weather, right? If you have more days like yesterday and today when it's cool and moist, you might get back on average. And that would be good, right? If we're ahead of average now and we have escaped the risk of freeze damage, well, there's a chance that grain filling may happen under slightly cooler conditions and bounce back our potential a little bit.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Throughout most of the U.S., wheat has become a rotation crop to help with disease and pest pressure.
Chandler Gould is CEO, National Association of Wheat Growers.
There's only a certain states that wheat is primarily the only crop that'll grow, and that's due to moisture. So, you know, as we continue to have leaders that are into a multiple cropping systems and a rotation crop, that definitely gives us a better feel for what else is out there, what kind of cropping systems work, how are we retaining moisture, and then as we continue to also look at other issues that we have for winter wheat specifically, some of the cover crop programs and climate smart solutions that are coming out that we continue to talk to the Secretary of Ag about, as well as Undersecretary Bonney, because right now wheat is being excluded from all the cover crop programs, especially winter wheat, because we have to harvest it. And so we are continuing to work with the Capitol Hill as well as with the USDA to try to fix this so that our winter wheat growers still can get credit for the carbon that they are sequestering over the winter with their living plant.
So that sets the stage for the latest global balance sheet. Mark Jackanowski, Chairman, World Ag Outlook Board.
A few things we can talk about here. Let's focus mainly on the new crop here. Smaller carry-in, that's mainly smaller carry-in in Russia and China. Feed use down, wheat feed use down, and we're just seeing more competitive feed grain, more lower corn prices, et cetera, makes wheat a little bit less competitive in feed rations. Total use up, some growth in FSI use there. Trade. Russia continues to lead globally, but next year, Russia's export forecast we reduced to 52 million tons, down from 53.5, a little bit smaller crop. Ukraine down as well, Ukraine exports down about 3.5 million tons to 14 next year on a smaller crop. Global exports up, on the other hand, so a lot of offsets here. Higher exports by Australia, U.S., Argentina, and Kazakhstan, among others. Ending stocks down, so down in most of the major exporting countries next year. U.S. supply and demand, so incorporating the information we got this morning from NASS, we made a small adjustment back here, truing up some export data, saw some, recent little bit strength in exports, so accounted for that in the back year. Of course, that marketing year is almost done. So now looking at the new crop year, imports down 20 million bushels. Again, maybe not too much of a surprise there. Higher U.S. production, lower U.S. prices. Food use, small increase there, just based on trends. Exports up. Again, maybe not too surprising given the higher production. But importantly, it's a pretty healthy increase, and that's off a 52-year low. So season average market price down next year. We're currently forecast at $6 per bushel. That's down $1.10 year over year, and lower corn prices are, partially to explaining that.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yesterday, we had 5,500 people.
Oklahoma Senator James Lankford.
If President Biden would just enforce the border the same way President Obama did, much less the same way President Trump did, the border would be very different. Everybody sees that. Everybody also sees that we need a change in the way we do asylum policy. That's a change that has to be done in Congress. That's a vote that we have to be able to take. So instead of us pointing at each other and doing political stunts, let's solve this. Let's actually sit down and figure out how we're going to resolve it. We can't do everything. The bill that I worked with Senator Murphy and Senator Sinema on, we're not going to be able to pass. So let's find the sections of it that we can pass. The worst case scenario is doing nothing. That's what we're currently doing. Now, the House of Representatives passed a bill yesterday saying that if someone who is not legally present here in the country attacks a law enforcement officer, whether that is state, local, county, federal, tribal, whoever it may be, if they attack a law enforcement officer, they're going to be deported. Well, it bipartisan passed over in the House yesterday. Is that coming here to the Senate? Probably not. It probably won't be taken up. But in a bipartisan way, it passed the House yesterday. We've had two different votes of a House bill that passed called H.R. 2 that was a very comprehensive bill dealing with all areas of border security. It passed the House. It came to the Senate. It's had two votes, and it's failed both times. So Republicans can now say Democrats didn't take our bill. And Democrats will, it looks like, going to bring things up and to say, well, Republicans wouldn't take the bipartisan bill. And we point at each other. And we're still in the same spot. Listen, the American people expect us to actually solve this, not just do politics on it. So here's my counsel. Stop doing all the political games. Let's stop bringing up the messaging bills. This is a national emergency. Of the 5,500 people that crossed the border yesterday illegally, I haven't seen the number yet, but I would tell you, in all likelihood, if it's tracking similar to other days, several dozen of those folks were designated by the Department of Homeland Security, this Department of Homeland Security, as special interest aliens. That is, they're coming from areas of known terrorism. They were designated at the border as a potential national security risk, and then they were released into the country awaiting a hearing. And by this afternoon, we'll have no idea where they are. That happens every day now. Because there's a large percentage of the people that are crossing the border every day now that are not from the Western Hemisphere. They're from West Africa. They're from all the Stan countries. They're from Pakistan. They're from India. They're from China. They're from Russia. They're from areas where we know there's active terrorist cells, but we just don't know this person. They're not on our list. But we do know that clan they're from, and that there are people from that clan in their particular tribe or their particular location that have been an issue. But because we don't have any derogatory information, they're being released every day. This has been the bell I have been ringing for months now. The immigration issue is not the same as what it was 2 years ago. There's been a huge shift in who is crossing the border, and we are not taking this seriously. This is a national security risk, and we need to be attentive to who is crossing our border every single day and take that seriously.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So this wheat quality tour, he has six different routes, right? The northernmost, the first day yesterday, we left from Manhattan and we went all the way to Colby, right? And the northernmost route, they go all the way into Nebraska. Then the second route goes bordering Nebraska on Kansas, so just go across Highway 36.
Romolo Lolato is a Kansas State wheat production specialist talking about the hard red winter wheat tour.
Then we have a route that pretty much goes through Highway 24, another one that goes through 18, then Highway 4 and Highway 56, right? So from way up north in Nebraska all the way down to 56 to central Kansas. In my particular route, right, in the north part of the state where we left Manhattan, went through Clay County, Washington, and then all the way west until Raleigh County and south to Colby. I seen think that a few of the talking points that I was seeing across the entire day was, number one, wheat streak mosaic virus. Every single field that we stopped in, we did 15 stops, every single field that we stopped in had some level of wheat streak mosaic virus. Some of them were fairly constant. It seemed like more like a spring infection, so I don't think that it is as problematic in reducing our yield as a fall infection, where it really stunts the crop, but it was consistent. That region around Bellevue and Republic County was probably where we saw the most. So again, throughout that entire Highway 36, we saw a lot of wheat streak mosaic, even as far east as Clay County. Another topic that we saw a lot yesterday was tripe rust. So I think that out of the 15 stops that we've done, probably 12 or 13 of them had active tripe rust pustules. And those fields, they were anywhere from out in Clay County, they were already going through early parts of grain sealing stage, kind of getting to the watery ripe stage, going more towards Bellevue and Phillipsburg. They were more around the flowering stage. And maybe as we're getting to Decatur and Raleigh County, they were more at the heading stage. So some of those growers, there's still time to spray for their fungicide, but that's going to come down to the economic decision, whether there is a yield potential in that crop to justify investing on a foliar fungicide or not. But stripe rust was active, and stripe rust was present in essentially all of those fields, or most of those fields. And then finally, freeze damage. We saw a lot of freeze damage in those fields that we were stopping by. Nothing that was necessarily, you know, too concerning in terms of, like, even thinking about abandoning a field because of that. No, not that, but, you know, we were going to do some spikelet counting ahead instead of having a potential 14, 15 spikelets that would produce grain. We may have had 11 or 12. So it's something that will take a hit on our yields as well. So that's the highlight of the route that I was at in Highway 36. But I also want to mention that other routes were very, very concerned with what they were seeing in terms of drought spread. And those routes were the ones that were either driving through Rooks County or south from there, like Ellis County, Rush County, Ness County, Lane. Those routes, they were reporting yields as low as 8 to 11 bushels per acre that were sampled. I would expect that these fields were probably going to be abandoned if we're having an 8 bushel per acre potential there. But we did not sample those in the route up north. We ranged from 20 to about 70 bushels per acre, averaging 49. But those routes that went, again, through Ellsworth and Hoisington and Rush and Ness and Lane, they were seeing some really rough wheat, and wheat that's probably going to be abandoned this year as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think probably the biggest impact had to do with prior converted wetlands. They can be farmed, but they revert to their protected status once they were abandoned. And abandonment could occur after 5 years of inactivity and could happen even in 1 year if there was an intent to abandon.
Roger McCohen is a Washburn University Ag Law Specialist on swamp buster rules.
So under the final rules, a prior converted wetland, which means you're not subject to the swamp buster rules, is a wetland that was totally drained before December 23, 1985. That's the effective date of the 1985 Farm Bill. And it's a wetland that is manipulated for the purpose or with the effect of making production of an ag commodity possible if that production would not have been possible but for the drainage activity. So the other problem that the final rules gave us was the concept of a farmed wetland, and that's a wetland that was drained before the 85 Farm Bill took effect, but still had wetland characteristics that remained. If that's the situation, then only the original drainage could be maintained. Now, once those rules came out, Shelby, we've had a lot of litigation on a whole host of issues with respect to swamp buster. So it's been kind of a minefield for attorneys that practice in that area of the law, which is the case anytime you have a government program with rules associated with it. The question is whether you qualify for an exemption under the rules or whether the rules actually apply to you or not.
What about a real life example?
The Foster case comes from southeast South Dakota. And this involves an 1/8 of an acre portion of a field that USDA certifies as a wetland in 2011 under the swamp buster provisions. And the wet area, when it had water in it, was about 8.5 inches deep at certain times of the year. Now, the interesting thing about this was that the wetland resulted, or the supposed wetland, I should say, resulted from a tree belt that had been planted in 1936 by Foster's predecessors to prevent soil erosion. So it's caused by trees that were planted to preserve the soil. Well, the snow in South Dakota accumulated around the tree belt in the winter. It melted in the spring, and sometimes you'd have water that would collect it in a low spot in the field without any drainage. It would have to soak into the ground or evaporate, and that happened about half the time, and it would dry out in time for planting. In other years, it had to be drained to plant crops. Well, Foster wanted a review of the certification that USDA had done or NRCS had done, and they basically, in essence, there were some machinations, but they refused to do that. And he again sought review of the certification in 2017, and USDA, NRCS didn't respond that time on the basis that he didn't provide any new information. Well, his argument was, I don't have to do this. This is not required by the statute. The statute says I have a right to request certification. You have to do it. And the USDA was saying, but we wrote regs that say that you have to show changed circumstances or that we made a mistake. And you couldn't do that, so we're going to ignore you. So that's why, how this ended up in court. So far, he has lost, and the lower courts have said that the agency's rule writing was within their purview. So they gave them deference on that. And this case currently is sitting there on a request for the U.S. Supreme Court to hear it. And at their conference in January, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't do anything with this case. They didn't say yay or nay. And I think they're holding it till they decide two major cases involving agency deference that they will decide probably in June. So after that, if they lower the deferential standard given to federal government administrative agencies, then I think they will hear the Foster case and we will get a ruling on the Grassley Amendment. If they go the other way, then we won't hear the Foster case. At least that's how I read the tea leaves right now.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This body knows full well I am not anti-immigration. We're a nation that has welcomed people in from all over the world, and we should continue to do that.
Oklahoma Senator James Lankford was one of the architects of the border security bill that failed in the Senate back in February.
We have 1 million people a year that legally become citizens of our country. But in the last 6 months, we've had 1.5 million people illegally cross into our country. That million that came in that became citizens of our country, they were vetted, they went through the process, they're being welcomed and integrated. That 1.5 million other folks that cross illegally, we have no idea. Some are coming to join family. Some are coming to be able to find a job. But some are no doubt also coming for nefarious purposes. And we can't tell the difference. So my counsel to us is, let's take this as serious as it actually is. Press conferences take one person. Passing law takes 60. That means we have to sit down together to be able to talk this through. We have to be able to figure out how we're going to actually get something done and at least make some progress. What is DHS currently doing? Well, DHS has just announced they're doing a rebranding of Homeland Security Investigators, of HSI. These are they're HSI ICE. Well, they're going to rebrand them and take away the ICE designation. So we're going to have a new logo and a new something else, and we're expecting a whole new listing of what they're going to actually do. At the same time, they're saying we don't have enough money to be able to get more Border Patrol, to be able to detain more people, to be able to deport more people. We're spending millions of dollars. We haven't seen the amount yet, but we're spending millions of dollars on rebranding HSI. We should take this moment as serious as it actually is. In the past 3 years, the price of groceries has gone up 20%. The price of gasoline has gone up 55%. But the price of fentanyl has gone down on the streets. We should take this moment as serious as it is. We have more drugs coming across our border based on the porous nature of what's going on, where migrants will come in, Border Patrol will engage with them for humanitarian purposes, and then the cartels will smuggle drugs 2 miles upriver or through the desert when they know that no one's watching that area. So we have a dramatic increase in fentanyl coming into our country, directly connected to 5,500 people that illegally crossed yesterday, 174,000 people last month, and 1.5 million in the last 6 months. What are we going to do about that? I hope not just talk about it. I hope not just do political messaging. I hope not just saying we'll bring up this bill to fail that we all know is going to fail. I hope it's actually sit down together and say, let's do the work to actually resolve this issue. That is what people sent us to do. I fully understand it's hard. I've personally experienced it. But we were sent here to do hard things. So we should probably start doing them. Let's get this solved.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There's a ranch. It's in Gillespie County. And Gillespie County, like a lot of Central Texas and the Hill Country, has seen really massive growth in the last few years, maybe last decade.
Melissa Hamilton is Executive Director, Government Relations, Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers.
And part of that growth has resulted in subdivisions. So once big ranches are now being subdivided into a lot for subdivisions. And a lot of times these subdivisions now sit right next to ranches that have not been subdivided. And so what happened in this case is the Bloxhams have a ranch, and there was a ranch next to them. And the two ranchers had worked together for years, but then the ranch next to them was sold and a developer bought that. And the developer asserted an easement. He claimed that there was an easement across the Bloxhams' property. And it's important to note at this point that there is no written easement in this case. So the Bloxhams said there was not an easement. The developer said there was and said that there had been some kind of verbal agreement throughout the years between the parties. The Bloxhams denied that. And anyway, so this developer, who, by the way, also had another right of access. He just wanted to use the Bloxhams ranch because it was more convenient. But he asserted that he had an easement to bring not only trucks and tractors and trailers and traditional farm equipment across the Bloxhams property, but also other bigger equipment. And so this ended up in court. The Bloxhams said that this developer did not have an easement. He asserted that he did. And what happened is that the court said, basically granted this developer an easement, a prescriptive easement, so a forced easement, basically, across the Bloxhams ranch on summary judgment. And so what that means is without hearing any evidence in the case, without having a trial by jury or a trial at the bench, so without any trial and without offering formal evidence, the judge just went ahead and ruled in favor of the developer and basically gave the developer that easement. That is a problem for many reasons. One, once that prescriptive easement is created, it lasts on and on. And second, it seems really concerning that you would create that kind of right-of-way or that right to that kind of right-of-way without a trial on the merits where you let people present evidence, especially in a case when there's not a written agreement creating the easement. But what's even, I guess, probably more concerning than that is that this is part of a trend we've been seeing in areas like Central Texas and the Hill Country where there's massive growth, ranches are being sold and subdivided. There's an increasing trend for trial courts to give easements to developers and others across private ranches on summary judgment without ever taking the issue to their peers via a trial. So there were kind of a couple, you know, really three things going on: the concerns about the individual case, and then the broader issue of the fact that this seems to be a trend. And so the Bloxhams took their case up on appeal. They appealed the trial court summary judgment. Had a really big win because the Court of Appeals from Amarillo reversed the trial court. They sent it back, agreeing with the Bloxhams and with TSCRA that at a minimum, that court has to hold a trial and let a jury of the Bloxham's peers decide whether an easement exists or not.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today,
the latest series of data sets associated with USDA's 2022 Census of Agriculture are now available, looking at data points by congressional districts. Information ranges from number of farms to producer characteristics. Among those studying these data breakdowns, Roger Cryan, chief economist of the American Farm Bureau Federation.
It's always helpful to know who the farmers are, where they are. It helps us demonstrate to senators and members of Congress who they're representing and give them some indication of the problems those folks are facing so that they can better understand the ways that they can help those constituents and help those folks keep the rest of us well-fed, clothed, and fueled.
The full Ag Census report is available online at www.nass.usda.gov/AgCensus, all one word. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.